Hello and welcome back to the Chem Talk podcast. On today's episode, we interview Dr. Philip Serby, Associate Professor in Plant Biology at UC Davis. He earned his PhD in plant physiology and now his research focuses on terpenoids, naturally occurring compounds in plants that function for their benefit. In plants, they are used as defense mechanisms for protection or signaling molecules to attract pollinators, but can also be utilized in the lab to improve crop traits and yield. We hope you enjoy today's podcast and be sure to visit our website at chemistrytalk.org. Hi, Dr. Serby. Thank you so much for speaking with us today. My name is Roxanne and I'm on the podcast team for ChemTalk. I'm a second year human health and disease student at Trinity College in Dublin, and I'm talking to you here today with my co-host Alejandra.
Hello, my name is Alejandra and I am a biology major at KSU. I've been with ChemTalk for over a year now. And I started writing articles, but now I'm more focused on making and editing content for our social media platforms.
Thank you, Alejandra. And Dr. Serby, would you mind giving us a brief introduction as to you and your research?
Not at all. So thanks for having me to start with. I'm happy to be here. So my name is Philip Serby. As you probably can hear from my accent, I'm not born in the States. I was born in Germany, did all my undergrad and graduate work there, then moved for some years to Canada to sort of dive deeper into plant-related research. And now I have my own lab here at UC Davis for the past 8 years. And sort of what my lab really focuses on is understanding how plants use the huge diversity of chemistry to communicate with their environment, to defend themselves against stress, and how we can use that knowledge for various applications from optimizing crops all the way to making plant-derived medicines.
Okay. And when it comes to your research, there's a few keywords that I'm wondering if you can kind of break down for us. And one of those things is the difference between primary metabolites and specialized metabolites.
Yeah, so primary metabolites and specialized metabolites sort of go back a long way. Nowadays, many people refer to general metabolites. Okay. So in the literature, you see that too, which are primary metabolites and secondary are equal to specialized metabolites. Mm-hmm. And so the difference, there's really a lot of overlap. So it's not a distinction in terms of chemical structure or function that is very clear. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of overlap, but generally speaking, primary or general metabolites are those that are essential for the survival and the development and reproduction of a plant. Mm-hmm. Right? So this includes your sugars. This includes amino acids. That includes plant hormones, for example. So metabolites that are absolutely critical under all circumstances for the survival of the plant. Specialized metabolites also enter those functions. But for the most part, those are now chemicals that plants produce and utilize under specific conditions. So these are compounds plants can use to interact with their environment, chemicals that they can use to attract pollinators, chemicals they can use to fend off pathogens or herbivores, right? So compounds that are not essential, but they're still very important under these, for example, stress conditions.
Okay. And when it comes to that, can you give an example of a specific one that any type of plant could utilize in response to a stress?
Yeah. So there are many different specialized metabolites that plants use to defend themselves. One thing that actually is important, that there's not really one that is in all plants. Mm-hmm. One other aspect that distinguishes primary and secondary or specialized metabolism is that general metabolites are abundant and conserved in all plants, or almost all plants, whereas specialized metabolites, as sort of the name implies, are very often species specific. So you often find them in only a single plant family, maybe a single plant species, often even only in individual tissue of a plant. So they're very specific and restricted. some of the compound classes that plants commonly use for these type of defenses are phenylpropanoids, terpenoids, alkaloids. These are sort of the major ones. And then there are glucosinolates, cytogenic glycosides. So these are the sort of what I would call the top five in terms of distribution and abundance.
Okay. And those all have unique ways in a plant of responding to like predators or pollinators, or so would you say that they could be like positive for the plant in terms of attracting pollinators and then also being able to be used as a defense mechanism to ward off predators?
Absolutely. So my lab focuses specifically on the class of terpenoids, in part because it's the most diverse class of metabolites with far beyond 100,000 different compounds produced by different plants. And so there are among these many compounds, there are some that you would definitely recognize as compounds plants use to attract pollinators, right? Like these are things like terpineol, linalool. So if you smell a rose, that sort of sweet smell, a lot of this is terpenoids, right? For us, that's very pleasant. Naturally, the rose uses it to attract pollinators, right? What's interesting is like with just a few changes of double bond arrangements, so slight changes in the structure, you can come to compounds like pinene that are actually toxic to insects. So pinene is a compound you would recognize when you tap a needle tree and the sap comes out, that smell, pinene contributes a lot to that smell.
Okay. So when it comes to terpenoids, are they the same thing as terpenes? Are they a class? How are they related?
Yeah. So terpenes and terpenoids are somewhat used interchangeably.
Okay.
You can use both. Sort of in the academic world, we use terpenoids to encompass all the compounds that are only hydrocarbons and those that are functionally modified, so carry oxidant functions and other types of functional groups.
Okay. And for us, we think of those as things that we can smell, right? In like plants and like lavender or citrus fruits, but they're actually so important for plants and how they interact with their environment and how they survive.
Yeah. And you would, all of us actually using terpenoids every single day. You just don't really know necessarily, right? So you mentioned the smell. So all your perfumes, your cosmetics, right? The citrusy smell of your shower gel, that is limonene. That's a terpene. Right? If you have your coffee with steviol as a sweetener, that is a terpene.
Okay.
So they're really all abundant in our daily life.
Okay. And just to backtrack a little bit, you said that a lot of these compounds have the same like germ origin. And I just like to confirm, when you say that, do you mean that they all kind of start off the same and then as these plants differentiate into species, it changes based on the plant?
Yes, in principle, yes. So and that's something that sort of drew me into work on terpenoids. Like all these more than 100,000 different chemical structures are actually formed from only two 5-carbon, very simple precursors that all plants make. In fact, all kingdoms of life make them. And somehow plants have gotten extremely good at taking these two very simple hydrocarbons and turn them into this massive chemical diversity. And so that over time, different species have evolved different ways of modifying these precursors into different compounds that have different bioactivities.
Okay. And can you think of any examples of a certain type of plant that can modify these, or just in general, how they can be modified and how the plants do that?
Mm-hmm. So all plants can modify them.
Okay. Right?
The formation basically is sort of what I would say is three major stages. The first one is just making these simple 5-carbon precursors.
Okay.
And the biosynthetic enzymes and pathways that do that are conserved actually in all kingdoms of life. There are two pathways and different kingdoms of life, like bacteria, humans, plants, use a different variation of these two pathways.
Mm-hmm.
But apart from that, it's fully conserved. After that, it gets complicated.
Okay.
Yeah. So the next step, so what you have is basically a linear hydrocarbon.
Okay.
And so the next step is that they are being cyclized.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Can get various different cyclic or acyclic derivatives of these precursors. Okay. That's your first, what I would say, like the first stage of diversifying. You can make lots and lots of different cyclic structures. Mm-hmm. Right? And once you have those, they are then further modified by various enzymes that can attach functional groups. So these can be oxygen functions, simple hydroxylations, carboxy group additions, acetylations, methylations, the list goes on and on and on. But this is right, like once you have the cyclic structure, all these various function modifications add to the bioactivity and really specify the bioactivity.
So that is to say that you have these five carbon precursors that are able to conserve pathways, or the enzymes that work with them are always the same. Like mm-hmm. they've been shown to work biologically, and therefore the plants continue to use them. Same as bacteria or pathways in humans.
Exactly. And only every species has a different set of enzymes that do slightly different reactions and slightly different modifications.
Okay.
That's what gets the biodiversity.
Okay, so those enzymes are able to take a linear hydrocarbon and make it cyclical?
Yes.
Okay, and then once they're cyclical, other enzymes can attach as functional groups, and that can change the function and make it more, I guess, unique and specialized for that plant.
Yeah, okay. Pretty much. You sort of can imagine it like, you know, that might be more my generation than yours as a Lego system, right? If I don't know if, you know, kids these days play still with Lego. I think they do.
Yeah, yeah. We
play with Lego. You know, the same idea is like you could have, right, a few Lego blocks and you can make a little structure out of them. And then you can add a whole lot of different kind of Lego blocks and, you know, modify in each which way. And sort of it's actually not a bad sort of analog for how terpene metabolism works and how these are made. Sort of the same idea. Lots of different bits and pieces that you can combine in a lot of ways to generate diversity. And that's exactly what plants do.
Yeah, that's so cool. I have a couple questions about some of your current research projects, and then I'm going to hand it over to Alejandra. So starting off, you are doing something with maize and its anti-pathogen defense and disease resistance system. So can you kind of explain your research on that and what you're working on with it now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the project on maize is now going on for over 10 years, in a while. And so it's a collaborative project with another group, Eric Schmelz's group at UC San Diego. What we know from Eric Schmelz's group is that terpenes are actually a major group of compounds in maize to defend the plant against some of the major pathogens. So maize is under threat of fungal pathogens dramatically, and even more so as our climate is changing. Like, harvest losses due to pathogens in maize are up to 30% in the US alone. So it's significant.
What makes maize particularly subjected to fungus?
That's a good question. I don't think it's particularly subjective. There are other species have similar problems, but just given the sheer abundance of maize cultivation in the US, it's just economically a major problem. Maize is one of the, if not the most cultivated food and biofuel crop in the US. And so it's just the sheer size and the harvest loss is significant because of that. But we know that terpenoids are the major defenses that maize uses against these fungal pathogens. And so when we started our collaboration, we knew of this importance, but we didn't know how maize actually makes these compounds. So we wanted to find out what are the biosynthetic enzymes, what are the pathways that maize uses to make these compounds that, as far as we know, only exist in maize. No other crop makes them. Similar ones, but not these ones. And so that was is a big part of our work, was to find out what are the enzymes that make these compounds. And we've made a lot of headway in that. What was really surprising to us is that we found the enzymes that make the terpenoid compounds we were interested in, but we also found a whole lot more. It actually turned out that our research resulted in new compounds, new terpenoids that we hadn't seen before in maize. So that was very interesting. And so we went back into the plant grown in the field to understand, are they really occurring in the plant? And it turned out they do. But they only are abundant in select varieties. Mm-hmm. Many of them, though, but not the ones that are usually used for research, which is probably why they hadn't been found before. And they are most abundant if maize is grown in the field, and they only accumulate, almost exclusively accumulate in the roots. Okay. Again, that was something new to us. So it turns out that maize produces a whole additional set of terpenoids that are abundant in the roots, and we don't exactly know what their function is yet. So that's ongoing in the lab, is to understand what these do. What we're thinking at the moment is that they're actually not exclusively defense chemicals against pathogens. Mm-hmm. But it seems likely from our research that they actually also have a function in attracting beneficial microbes in the soil. We don't know how. We're working on that to understand it. But at the moment, that's what we're thinking might actually be happening there.
Okay. And could you give us an example of one of those beneficial microbes and how it might help maize?
Yeah. So every plant and every crop actually uses, for example, the exudation, so the release of sugars into the soil to attract microbes. And so these are various different species of microbes that essentially live around the root of a plant and help the plant, for example, with uptake of micronutrients, uptake of nitrogen, right? Various things that the plant needs to grow. And it undergoes an interaction with these microbes to accomplish that.
Is that similar at all to, I'm forgetting what it's called, but when plant roots and like fungus kind of come together underground and exchange nutrients?
Exactly. It's okay. Exactly like that. And we have it too, right? So your gut microbiome,
It's
exactly the same idea, right? Those microbes help you digest your food and provide your body with micronutrients and other metabolites that you need, but couldn't actually break down just by yourself.
Okay.
Same idea, right? We do it in our gut, plants do it in their roots and soil.
Yeah. And do you think there's any difference between what the terpenoids that you find in the plant roots based on the location of where it's grown?
We're starting to try and understand that. We definitely see a differences in those microbes and a differences in the abundance of these terpenoids, depending on in what type of soil we grow the plants. And also different varieties of maize show very significant differences in these compounds. So we're actually working on trying to understand how those differences translate into how resistant a maize variety is to stress. Okay. And if you could use that for breeding. Right?
Okay, so you would potentially find the really highly specialized terpenoids that are really, really good at warding off pathogens or pests or whatever, and then try to engineer those in new crops so that the yield could be really high?
Yes. So technically, yes. What we're trying to actually avoid is to actively have to engineer them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the idea, that obviously would be possible. Yeah. And it's one strategy you can use to make a more resilient crop. Yeah. The alternative could be, right, if we find varieties that are naturally higher in these compounds and are naturally more resistant to these pathogens because of those terpenoids, those would be ideal parents for just traditional breeding of maize.
Right? And that's, do you avoid pests becoming or gaining, what is it, when they can kind of overcome that and make new varieties of themselves that can then be pathogens for the plant? So do you overcome that when you just take like the natural parents instead of engineering it?
The outcome would probably be very similar. We will not ever sort of breed or engineer a crop that for the rest of days will be resistant to some pathogen, right? The pathogens always adapt and the plant will co-evolve, and the breeding essentially is sort of pushing it along a little faster in that evolution, right? And so you will always have to readapt, right? You will design a crop that is more resistant for a period of time. That is one of the major challenges of our time, is that these pests and pathogens develop rapidly. Mm-hmm. And more so as our climate is getting hotter and drier. So around the world, that is one of the major challenges. So how do we continually address that?
And before I pass this off to Alejandra, can you tell us what is the Strawberry Project?
Ah, it's a very popular project in the lab. So the tools we're using and the ideas are very similar to our maize work. The difference is that in the Strawberry Project, we're not actually interested in how terpenoids contribute to pathogen defense. Mm-hmm. We are interested in their role in providing aroma.
Right? Okay.
So we're actually working directly with the California strawberry farmers on this project who guide us on this. What we are seeing is sort of in many crops, like tomato is very widely discussed like that, is that the modern varieties have lost sort of the complexity of the aroma, right? You get big, red, sweet strawberries and they're very tasty. But if you eat a wild strawberry, it's less sweet, smaller, but it has all these aromas. Mm-hmm. And so what we want to do is to actually understand how this aroma that is coming to a large degree from terpenoids has been lost in the process of domesticating strawberry and breeding it back in without losing all the sweetness and all the beautiful big red strawberries, but making the aroma more complex and just better, even better tasting than the ones we have now.
Okay. So you think what you were saying is you think you can breed that back in to increase the aroma?
Exactly. Okay. That's it. But in order to do so, right, we have to understand what are the terpenoids that actually contribute to that nice aroma in the wild strawberries, and what are genes in the genome that drive the production of these aroma metabolites. And if we have that information, we can go to the breeders and say, you have to focus on these genes. Right. And that can allow us to specifically choose parents and do what we call precision or targeted breeding.
Okay.
Right, of specific traits, in this case, aroma.
Okay. And so that's what you're working on now. Mm-hmm. How far are you in this project?
We've been working on it for about 2 years now, and we have collected enormous amounts of data. We have tested above 200 different strawberry varieties to understand their flavor profiles and aroma profiles and understand the genes behind it. But it's still somewhat early days. This is not a fast process to really understand what has happened in the process of domestication. So it will be a few years. But meanwhile, we are already working on breeding new varieties with different kinds of aromas. So it's definitely progressing.
And do you get to eat them?
Sometimes. It's more, I'm rarely in the field, unfortunately. Okay. But the students who go into the field certainly get to snack on a few. And we do have every now and then actually tasting panels here on campus where students and anyone can come to and taste strawberries.
That sounds like a really good project to have people get involved in on campus.
Yeah, it's definitely very popular with the students.
So now I'm going to hand it over to Alejandra, who I believe has some questions for you as well.
What makes switchgrass special or resilient when overcoming drought season?
Very good question. And something that we would love to find out and we're working on. So switchgrass is a dedicated bioenergy crop and a fodder crop. So it's very different from maize in its industrial use, but it is known to be extremely drought tolerant. One physiological reason for that is that many of the switchgrass varieties have very deep, large root systems. So it would allow them to access water where other crops, but it's probably not the only reason. Right? So, you know, with our focus on terpenoids, when we started to work on switchgrass, we were really interested to understand, does switchgrass make terpenoids? If so, are they different from those we find in, say, rice and maize? And what do they do? And what we found is that, yes, switchgrass makes terpenoids. In fact, switchgrass has the largest family of enzymes almost in all known plants outside of eucalyptus trees and grapevine. to make terpenoids, and it makes terpenoids we haven't seen anywhere else in the plant world at all. We're still not really sure what they do. So we just actually published a new paper a few days ago that shows that switchgrass accumulates terpenoids in its root system in response to drought. So that's very exciting because it suggests that maybe these terpenoids actually have something to do with the drought tolerance of switchgrass. But for now, we only know they are produced and they accumulate in the root when they're under drought. We don't really know if that's now really a function in drought. That is a few years of work properly down the road to understand that. But it's very encouraging, very exciting to see that there seems to be a role of terpenes in the context of drought.
So would you say that switchgrass is the most resilient, or are there any other plants that are similar to switchgrass or more resilient?
Well, there are certainly plants that are more resilient to drought than switchgrass, right? Like if you think about, you know, us here in California, we have a lot of plants, like from cacti to other plant species that are extremely resilient to drought. Among the grasses that switchgrass belongs to, switchgrass certainly is one, if not the most drought tolerant. It varies a little bit. Again, there are many different varieties of switchgrass, and they actually differ in how drought tolerant they are. But those are really common in sort of the prairie lands of the US are very drought tolerant. So we usually do 4-week drought treatments for our plants, which means we don't water them at all. And the resistant variety of switchgrass after those 4 weeks are still happy green plants, which is remarkable. If you don't water your plants at home for 4 weeks, they don't look happy anymore. It's quite remarkable how much drought they can handle.
What made you passionate about plant research?
Good question. I think I always was fascinated with the natural world. As a kid, I was, you know, obsessed about like reading books and watching movies from people like David Attenborough and Bernard Shimek, like the zoologists that travel the world and explore it. That was my thing. And I think ultimately through school and early days of university, I fell in love with plants just because it's so incredibly complex. Like for me, like where we write, use words as a way to express ourselves, plants use chemicals. That's how they interact with their world. And like as I started to study biology and like sort of first sort of plant biochemistry and plant physiology classes, I just was blown away by how complex that actually is. And I got hooked, and it's been 20 years and I still love it. And I don't think I'll ever stop learning. There's so much diversity out there that we don't understand in terms of plant chemistry and what we can do with it. It's quite astonishing.
That's awesome. And what are your favorite plants and why?
Oh, what are my favorite plants? That's a very good question. I do love like the members of the mint family a lot, just because they produce tons of different terpenes, very complex mixtures, and they smell really good. They look really lovely, and you can use them for a lot of different things. And I'm always really fascinated by those. Personally, I'm super fascinated by exotic plants and sort of the range of medicinal plants, various different medicinal plants. Sort of a little story is I actually a few days ago came back from a work trip to Ecuador. To start a student exchange program there. So we spent days in the jungle with local communities who explained to us all the different medicinal plants and how they use it. And it's incredible how much there is and how little we know about that. And that's sort of a particular fascinating area of research that I would love to explore further.
So what was your favorite research to do?
I think my favorite research probably is work on medicinal plants and sort of rare plants or unusual plants that make interesting chemistry. I think my favorite project throughout my almost entire career was a project where we tried to make natural precursors for Ambrox. So Ambrox is a component of sort of high value perfumes. It's called a base note. So it's a compound that prevents the floral volatile notes to evaporate slower. And so traditionally Ambrox was actually harvested from sperm whales. That's banned by now. You can't do that anymore. But there are plants that actually make the precursors to make Ambrox chemically. And so as a postdoc, I had a project to actually figure out how a conifer tree called balsam fir makes this precursor. And we found the enzyme and we got to actually patent it and license it to industry. And that was just super exciting to sort of see research going all the way from the discovery to actual applications and making these compounds more sustainably.
And there is one more question. What advice, it's more of a, I guess, a personal question. What advice during the time you were a college student made a big impact on you as part of your professional journey?
As a college student, it's been a few years. Like for many people, it often is sort of right one specific instructor, like a teacher who manages to inspire you. Often it's people who just excited themselves about that topic they teach and just captivates you. And I had one of or two of those that were teaching plant physiology and biochemistry that you just feel they were excited about it, and it excited me. And you know, as you go through college, that's sort of where you find your way and what you really are into. The other thing that really drove me is that I early on, like actually from the first semester on, I started to work in a lab. So I got my hands wet right away and I loved it. And so that instructor too gave me a chance to continue working with her, and it was fantastic. I think those two things really drew me into science and inspired me to move into this field of research.
Do you have any questions, Roxanne?
So would you mind just expanding on this exchange program that you're setting up between Ecuador and the US?
Sure. So since I started my own lab, I've been working to try and connect students internationally. Having worked in different countries and been away from my own home country for many, many years now, it's not easy to do, but you grow immensely, both personally and professionally. And I like the idea of students to learn from each other what science is like in their country, the challenges, the opportunities, and to also just build an international network and science friends. So I've done this, I'm involved in a student exchange program with two student exchange programs actually with Japan in Osaka and in Nara at the National Institute of Technology there. Mm-hmm. And more recently, I met a colleague in Ecuador. And so we started talking. And so she's at a very new university. It's very small, that is directly in the Amazon.
Okay.
And so when we talked, we liked the idea of doing something to get students in California and students in Ecuador connected. Mm-hmm. And so we managed to secure some seed funding to go down there. And actually, I took two of my students with me and we taught a class in Ecuador on biotechnology and plants. And we're hoping that that success will sort of lead us to now get some funding to actually bring students from Ecuador to UC Davis and vice versa.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we'll start an online journal club so that the students can meet, get to know each other. I really like to do these things because I feel like the students benefit immensely from it, to just meet each other, learn about each other's research, and get a much bigger horizon about what research is like across the globe.
Absolutely. And when it comes to things that we could learn from people who are more connected to using plants medicinally, as opposed to how we've kind of evolved into pills as like what's prescribed, what are the most important things that you think we could really take away from studying how other people utilize plants in medicine?
Research-wise, it's just an enormous untapped resource mm-hmm. of medicinal uses. I think what is critical to really do that is that we have to find a way to sustainably work with the communities who develop that knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We have to understand how they use these plants. And that's knowledge that's handed from one person to the other. Right? And we have to do that in a way that does not harm their traditions, does not exploit their traditions, that involves them in the research and also in the economic use of these things. And that is a tricky process.
Yes.
Right? But that is the critical part. And what particularly impressed me in Ecuador is that the students actually go out to the local communities. They spend time with them and learn how to use those plants.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go back to university and do metabolite analysis and these kind of things. I think where we're not yet is to figure out how we can make that research meaningful to the communities.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It has to go in a circle.
Yeah.
And that is something we have to do and have to figure out. And I would love to say I have an idea or a solution. I don't at this point. But I think if that connection could be established, it would be enormous what we could do with that.
Yeah. And can you comment on potentially any differences in the ways that you've recognized how people in Ecuador utilize medicinal plants and how people in Japan utilize them as well? Are there differences? What are the specific plants that you've seen be utilized for things that maybe we don't utilize them for? Do you have any opinions on that?
Yeah, I mean, Japan and Ecuador certainly are very different, right? Like, there's a lot of traditional knowledge also in Japan. It's hard to say. I mean, personally, I would think that there's probably more of, not of an acceptance, but a more wide use of mm-hmm. Western medicine and the style of Western medicine.
Yeah.
In Ecuador, that's very clearly distinguished from what I saw over those last few weeks, where there is the community knowledge and the knowledge of the shaman.
Yeah.
And they very clearly distinguish that from the Western medicine. They're not conflicting, they're just different things for them. And their knowledge is expansive, just expansive of what they can do and the treatments they have found. I think what I really learned personally is that at this point in time, my knowledge and what I can do in research really doesn't mean much to them. It's not, they don't need it, right? And that's an important lesson maybe to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we need their knowledge much more than they need ours. And so I would love to find a communication, a connection to find out how what we do could actually be beneficial to them.
Yeah. And would you, I know you said you don't have too many ideas as to like how to go about that, but would that potentially look like asking them what they want from you or from us generally? Like if they don't really need anything from us, then how do you really circle back?
Yeah, I think it probably goes beyond the knowledge. What I could envision is, can we find a way to utilize their knowledge and develop Western or modern medicines from it in a way that economically involves them, right? Mm-hmm. Could the transfer of this knowledge and a collaboration between those two worlds be of economic benefit to them in a sustainable way?
Yeah.
That could be potentially one avenue.
Yeah.
Right? To not just go in and take the plans, but figure out a way how, right, that could be a shared ownership of knowledge
mm-hmm.
and of whatever we could do with those plans. That it's not an easy route for sure.
Yeah.
But for me, that could be one way that I would love to explore if that's possible.
How, I know it's difficult to define, but how to break that barrier between respect towards their culture and sharing that knowledge that they have?
Yeah, I think it's all about trust. I mean, in the end, we're all people, right? I think for me, the way is that next generation. Right. That's why I'm interested in these student exchanges. If I see those students work with the local communities and they establish a working relationship and a trusting relationship, that's a generation that can communicate these things. That's a generation that can work together. It'll take time. But to me, that's the way, is to you know, use what I can do and give those students a chance to learn from the communities, but also come here and learn how things are done and how research is done in the States and have a chance to see both worlds. And that might equip them to do something that I cannot do. I mean, long shot, but I think this is a long process and it has to involve this next generation of scientists.
When it comes to motivating and kind of inspiring your students in your lab, what do you do and what advice would you give to anyone in chemistry or really just in the sciences in general in terms of how they can really make the most out of their academic journey?
That's probably the most exciting, but also the hardest part of my job. Mm-hmm. Because my responsibility is to sort of fuel that inspiration and that love for science, but at the same time, make sure that at the end of your time in my lab, you're ready for the job market and you can compete and succeed. Those things don't always go hand in hand, right? Sometimes there's science you might not find super interesting, but it gets you ahead and it gives you training you need. I mean, the way I try to do it is that usually students in my lab are involved in what project they want to work on. Like as an undergrad, you come in and you start helping more senior students, and then maybe you get a summer fellowship and you can explore like your own project a little bit. So it's a gradual process. As a graduate student, I usually have a discussion with my students when they join. Mm-hmm. So I get an understanding of what they want to do, and then I look at the projects that are available and see what's possible. Mm-hmm. And so that's a continued process. I also usually have regular discussions with my students on their career ideas, mm-hmm. assuming that they will change on a regular basis. And sort of depending on what they want to do, I usually see that they have opportunities to explore that. So say I have a student who wants to go into industry, they usually take sort of additional workshops in entrepreneurship and management mm-hmm. to get them ready. And also for them to feel out if that side of the job is actually for them. Mm-hmm. If I have a student who is really interested in, you know, teaching or other kind of aspects, I'll probably involve them in that. Right, or take them with me on these type of international collaborations to explore those options. So it's a constant communication to sort of feel out what they want to do and at the same time push them hard enough to be ready.
Right? Yeah. And when it comes to people who are maybe in high school or even younger, what would you say to them to kind of give them a push just in general?
Just go out and explore. Right, like apply for internships at a university or in a company that maybe takes high school students. Just write an email yeah. to people like me. The worst thing that can happen is you don't get an answer.
Yeah.
So you write another email and eventually one will stick. Mm-hmm. And you get to explore a few weeks, a couple of months of what research is like. Right? And it might be great, or maybe you don't like it. That's fine too. Then you know that, right? Yeah. And try something else, but just try and apply for these opportunities and, you know, be proactive in doing that. And I think the more you gain experience, the more you have an idea of what might really catch your attention and what you want to do.
Yeah. And especially just going off of that, apply for anything you can, even if you maybe don't have the requirements it's asking for. Because like you said, the worst that's going to happen is a no or no response. And I have a friend who very much lives by just apply. And she has gotten internships that she's really excelled in, even though she maybe didn't have the requirements that they were looking for. So it's always worth it to just try and just apply.
Yeah, it's just part of a career in science. It's, you know, you try. I still do that, right? I have to apply for funding all the time. Sometimes I get it, sometimes I don't. Right, but yeah, just try. That's what I would do.
Alejandra, any last questions?
I don't have any other questions.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Zerbe. We really enjoy talking to you today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this podcast episode or simply want to know more about chemistry, visit us at chemistrytalk.org and follow us on all social media platforms, including Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok by searching ChemTalk. Thank you and see you next time.